Mouthing Off is a theater, arts, and culture podcast from Bad Mouth Theater Company in St. Paul, Minnesota. I'm Amanda Forstrom.
I'm Kevin Couchman.
And I'm Mari Sittner. Mouthing Off features compelling interviews and discussions with artists and creators from around the Twin Cities and beyond.
Tune in for something different online where you get your podcasts at badmouthtc.com and on the air in St. Paul through Frogtown Radio 94.1 FM.
And if you've got something going on around the Twin Cities you'd like to talk about, we want to hear from you. Email us at badmouthtc@gmail.com.
Mouthing Off is sponsored by Minnesota Playlist, the digital destination for live performing arts. Producers can find talent to work with, directors can cast productions with audition ads, teachers can find students with a classified, and audiences can find the perfect show to attend on the state's largest calendar of theater and dance shows. Find out more at minnesotaplaylist.com.
We hope you enjoy the show. Hello and welcome back again. Thank you for tuning in again to Mouthing Off, a theater, arts, and culture podcast. Thank you if you're listening on 94.1 FM Frogtown Radio, but let's be honest, you're probably not. You should, but you're probably on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, hopefully our website. That would be cool too. We are back with another fun episode. I'm here in New York City. We're getting a beautiful September. Our horrible lantern flies are back in bloom and they're flying in everybody's face. And, you know, I can only hope that things are better where you are, Amanda, in beautiful Minnesota. How are you?
I'm doing fantastic. We're kind of winding down our wet summer that we've had and it's kind of cooler than usual. But, you know, I might be ready for fall. I'm a true Midwestern Minnesota girl at heart, I guess, because I'm ready for fall. Is that even though I love hot weather, which is so weird. So anyway, but I'm super excited because we're going to talk film today, which it's been quite a while since we've nerded out on that medium. So I'm really super excited. And just to get to know our guest a little better. And Mari, would you like to introduce our guest?
Yes, we are here today with an actor, though I believe not in this project. Maybe I'm wrong, but writer and director and producer, Josh David Jordan. Josh, how are you?
I'm fantastic. Thank you so much. Yeah, since we're doing weather talk, it's still hot in Texas. I live in Dallas, Texas, but we're gearing up for the Texas State Fair, which means fall is coming. So yeah, I'm a fall guy. I was born at the end of October, Hallows Eve. And so I get very excited about the fall.
You a Scorpio? Oh my gosh.
I am Libra. A Scorpio.
Oh, you're a Scorpio. Yeah. Oh, I'm a Scorpio. I'm Libra. I'm the 20th of October.
Okay, yeah.
Yes. And our great Minnesota get together, as it is called, the state fair, the Minnesota State Fair just ended. So, that's ended. And now it's kind of like that is the transition to fall.
Come on down to see Big Tex. Keep the fair vibes going.
Before we get started, I want to do a super small plug, just since we're talking about the Minnesota State Fair. I have a very good friend who just sent me a bunch of pictures from there because he is in Million Dollar Quartet in Duluth. I cannot remember the name of the theater right now, but if you want to go see Million Dollar Quartet in Duluth, you can go see my great coworker, Drew Black. Get your tickets. It's in the middle of September. It's coming up. But now that we're done talking about that, Josh, you're here to talk about a movie. Do you want to plug your movie?
Oh, sure. Yeah. It's the season, not just of fall, but of plugging my new film, El Tanto Per Cristo. It's my second feature film. This is a black and white European cinema style narrative feature film about a group of monks on the coast of Texas. It's a film told in vignettes about Orthodox monks in Texas. And yeah, that's kind of the story. And this, you know, the main, I guess, elevator pitch is it's we're watching their struggle towards sainthood, and they, you know, they're unlikely fools. So yeah, that's sort of the elevator pitch. I could be totally messing that up. I have other people do a really good job of this. And for some reason, the writer and director, it's like I freeze up, but I'm like, what am I talking?
Yeah, it's so hard to plug your own stuff. You just have to memorize the log line, but then every single time you give it out, you want to say every single thing that the project is about and you just totally lose it. But I think a good place to start is the title, which is El Topo por Cristo, El Tonto por Cristo, excuse me,
You
which
got it.
means fool for Christ, right?
Correct. Yes. So I live in, like I said, Dallas, Texas. I live in a very Tex-Mex part of the world, really. And I grew up in the restaurant and restaurant business and bartending, and there's a lot of Spanglish that happens. And when you're around Dallas, a lot of things are in like a Tex-Mex type of language. And I wanted it to feel, sometimes I think the film is more than The Fool for Christ. Sometimes that can be a really misleading title, right? And sometimes I think people use it as maybe like a propaganda grab, like a title grab. And we wanted to stay as far away from that as possible. And once I got El Tonto por Cristo in my head, it was always like the placeholder. And everyone was like, oh, I like the title. And some people were like, I don't like the title. And so it was like a 50-50 split. And I'm like, oh, that means we have something. I think it's Quentin Tarantino that said, if half of the people hate your film and then half the people love your film, you've made a great film. So with the title, I thought we're on to something then. So yeah, El Tonto por Cristo.
Yeah, and so I know that on the, obviously, if it doesn't say everything about the film, there is a bit on your site about the concept of the holy fool. Do you want to sort of explain what that is to people who may
Yeah,
not
for
know,
sure.
like I did not know.
Yeah, it's it's very ancient. It was something that a lot of holy people who were more enlightened or say clairvoyant who had, different spiritual gifts, they never wanted to draw attention to themselves. They always wanted to give the glory to God. And so sometimes they would act erratic. They would be homeless. They, the list goes on and on and on to really make people, not interested in them or almost like repulsed in a way, so that all the glory went to God. So they were called holy fools. And a lot of them would go off into the desert. Some of them like would live in trees, and people would say that they're crazy. And so it would, like I said, put the mirror back on Christ or God. So the holy fool.
Yeah, and I mean, I want to know a little bit more about sort of what the, I mean, obviously this is a terrible question about what the movie is sort of about with a small A. Give us a little bit of the plot rundown and maybe how that concept of the holy fool fits in before we dive deeper into the production and everything.
Yeah, for sure. So, I've been Orthodox for about 11 years. I grew up very, in the South, Southern, and my dad's a traveling evangelist still to this day. So I was very, very far from like ancient traditions. And when I became Orthodox, I was always really, really enamored and always dove deep into the holy fools. There's stories of, people that were in like vaudeville circuses that were clowns that became saints and monks and holy fools. And there was just something that really brought me to that because, I have a lot of friends. They're very scholarly. They're very academic. And that's not really my forte. Mine is, I have a, I'm on a theater podcast and my whole life is, in theater. And I met a lot of my cast, in the theater. And, yeah, and so the film is, it takes place on the coast of Texas. Like I said, it's a fictional, a narrative film. And I wanted to create something mysterious, sort of magical, and a little Tim Burton-esque, as in like something that is probably not a real place, but also has realness based into it. And so we shot in different locations all over Texas, and it encompasses four monks. There's other monks that you see throughout the film, and it's four monks, and they all have their different struggles. And so, like I said, they're kind of vignettes in that European cinema style. The film is all locked down. We just shot on a tripod and didn't move the camera very much. There's a couple zooms. A lot of this is one takes. A lot of blocking goes involved with that, and so that's where the theatrical part probably comes into play of being able to do that. And yeah, we just follow these four different monks and we go back and forth. And a lot of people, I think, that have watched the film so far identify with different monks because they all come from different walks of life, but they're all kind of cut from the same cloth. And, the spin, I guess, really is who is the holy fool as you watch the film. We have one major main character, Matthew Posey, he plays the lead, and I met him 15 years ago at the Okra House Theater here in Dallas.
Okay, excellent. So, a quick plug before we forget, how can people watch the film?
Yeah, so the film is locked and loaded, and we are kicking things off in Dallas, Texas on October 6th. And then we go on a Texas tour, and then we're coming to Minnesota. We'll be in East Coast, West Coast. We're going to Greece. We're going to Romania. So it'll be a theatrical run. And I was going to look up the dates. I'll do that here in a second. I should know when the Minnesota dates are. And so we wanted this to really be an event, a theatrical release, just because the film is very still. It's very quiet. It demands your attention. And also, I know people would like to gather in the lobby or the bar and, you know, talk about the film and discuss it. So obviously it will be on streaming. It'll be on Blu-ray the first of next year. But we're really giving this a really big push to have things in theater. I like to watch movies in theater. It's really important to me because it's just the whole experience. You know, it's even watching theater that during the pandemic, you know, it was like a lot of, you could go to an AMC and wear a mask and watch theater. And I would watch theater and support my friends on the laptop. But there's just nothing like being in a dark theater, turning off your phone and entering a magical place. And I really believe that El Tanto Pa' Cristo, we bring you to a magical place. And if people can catch it in a theater, I think it's the best experience.
Absolutely. I'm not as much of a film buff as Mari and Kevin are, but they go hard, let me tell you. They go hard, which is awesome. But I, for as little as I know about European film and that style, I it's interesting that you made this, and I want to hear more about how this sort of came to be, and how long you've been working on the script. Because it's coming at a time where I feel like, and we've talked about this on the podcast before, where we're kind of lost our American art, where we're very lost in the American theater. What does that mean after this pandemic? And who are we? What is our culture? What are we trying to say? And where do we go from here? And I think that's also kind of happening with film too, in a sense. And we also are seeing at the same time this sort of, you know, really strong rebirth of practicing Christians, young, like Gen Z practicing Christians and Catholics as well, specifically. So I'm wondering kind of when this, so I feel like this, your film is hitting at a very interesting time for our society and, how did this project for you kind of start as an idea, and how fast did it come together? Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, for sure. And I do think that America has lost its way for sure. Like, we had those moments when, you know, the 60s and 70s and, you know, there's the Raging Bulls and Easy Riders that were all happening. And we were onto something because they were influenced by European cinema. And then vice versa, it kept happening. And then I think when the blockbusters came out, you know, that's why they're called blockbusters, because when Jaws came out, it was competing against, I think Star Wars had just done, it was Jaws, and there was lines around the blocks and they were causing traffic jams. They were calling them blockbusters. And, you know, it became a business. And they looked more towards the profit, which I totally you have to understand it, but it was never, we have lost the art form in a way. I think that, you know, films, companies like A24 still try to bring that back, but there's still, you know, the smell of business. There's an aroma of business still there. And I think a lot of European films still are guided on the art form. And so for me, I have two other films that were ready to go, as in, like, you know, I'd written them, working on another one, and I just kept feeling like, oh man, there's no Orthodox American films. Like, there's zero. There's some documentaries, but a lot of the documentaries take place in Russia or Greece. And there's some narratives, but those are always Russian or Greek. And there was not anything that was an American tale that was out there. There was zero. And so I was like, oh, it'd be so great to have... I guess waiting for someone to make an American Orthodox movie, but make it not like, I don't want to step on any toes, but like, you know, some evangelical films are a little bit formulaic. And when you say a Christian movie, sometimes people cringe a little bit. Mm-hmm. And, you know, not saying that all of them are like that, but it is a little bit of a, it's a system, you know, it has its own algorithm, and it's just, you crank it out and you print it. And I was like, where's the, you know, it doesn't have to be a Christian film. It can have the tapestry of it. You know, Andrei Tarkovsky made a film called Andrei Rublev, which is, I mean, he was Orthodox. He was Russian. It's about an Orthodox iconographer. Mm. But when you watch the film, it's so much more, even though the tapestry is about an Orthodox iconographer. And I was like, oh, someone needs to make that. And counting myself out in a way, because even though I'm 11 years Orthodox, I feel like, you know, I'm not Orthodox enough in a way to make this film. And it just kept sitting with me and sitting with me. And that's how I made my first film, This World Won't Break. My wife was watching me scroll on Netflix, and she's like, what are you wanting to watch? And I was like, I'm wanting to watch a movie about a country singer who's in his 40s and he doesn't make it. What happens? And she was like, what do you mean? I was like, well, there's the fall from grace, like Crazy Heart, or there's the rise to fame, like the other films. And I was like, what happens if you don't make it? And she's like, well, maybe you should make that movie. And then I did. And so I think that's the reason we have El Tanto Por Cristo, is I really wanted to put a film about Orthodoxy out there that wasn't, I guess, propaganda or pushing religious points of view, but just including it in the film and having something that's really interesting and putting art first. And that's why the film is, it's in black and white. And there was a lot of pushback from different distribution companies and people that passed on the film, because they were like, well, you should probably do a color version for Americans. And I'm like, that's what I'm talking about. You know, this is the problem that we're having, is it's almost like we're children and people are dumbing things down for us, you know? And it's like, you can't understand this, so we're going to dumb this down. And so I wanted to show respect to people and be like, hey, here's this film, and you may not understand it the first go around, but this is what we're making. And so that was kind of the reason.
That is so crazy, because I've mentioned this on the podcast before about, we call it the Disneyfication of art, because it really, you know, I watched this production of Once, and the stars were this, you know, Abercrombie and Fitch model looking guy and this young, pretty, like, you know, pop singer kind of girl, and, you know, and they did fabulous work. But a huge part of that story is that this guy was a failing musician. She was an immigrant working hard and couldn't find her place and was lost. And they found each other, but they didn't end up together. But they, you know, it's this sort of sparkly and colorful version of it that we are all presented. And it really, the thinking that the audience needs to be, you know, you need to like feed them along and string them along, and that they can't piece this something together themselves or dream or imagine or create or whatever, is just, that whole notion of that is ridiculous, because then as Kevin so lovingly calls it, it becomes vitamin theater, right? Mm-hmm. Where it's like, here, take your vitamins. You're going to watch it. Or like the pre-show speeches, like, you're going to watch a show about this. It's like, well, I just wanted to watch the show. Now I guess I don't, because you told me what it's about, so I can go, you know, I just want to sit, like you said, in a dark room and just like experience and have it just come at me, you know. Mari, go ahead.
Yeah, I was just like, that is exact. I mean, obviously we talk about this all the time and we completely agree, but I think like going back to what you said about a lot of Christian films, you know, the heavens is for real of it all, is that so much of it is actually just as kind of corny and formulaic and like unartful and unintegrated as a lot of the kind of like, you know, for lack of a better word, like woke slop that we're inundated with. And I think that particularly, like, I think this is a particularly American problem where religion is just like maybe not well integrated enough into our culture. And so we're not super good at integrating it into our art either. I mean, I just read yesterday, I had nothing to do, I sat down, and for the first time in 10 years, I read Franny and Zooey. If you guys have not read Franny and Zooey, the Salinger book that is about a girl going through a spiritual crisis, and it's a very Christian book. And it's just this beautiful meditation on like what it means to be Christian and give Christ to other people. And that's obviously a very simple concept. But I'm curious why you think before, I have so many questions about being Orthodox. I don't know nothing about it. But why do you think that it's so difficult, particularly in America, to make a religious film?
Yeah, I mean, I really do. I mean, this is such a young country, you know, to begin with. And it's filled with, we're all immigrants, right? Everyone came here. And I think that the foundation of, you know, even the evangelical, it's something that I think it was the comedian Andrew Schultz who was talking about, you know, you have this, and then this turns into the evangelical, then it turns into a non-denominational, then it turns into a .com, then it turns into we're a satellite church, and you're getting farther and farther away. And I don't mean to use the word watered down, but it does become thin. And I think a lot of times when there's thinness, people really want to push a message then, right? Whatever their message is. And I think with having something like the Orthodox faith, it's 2,000 years old. And I don't think that you need to, and it's also doesn't need to explain itself in a way, I guess, just because of the history of it. And it's integrated into your lives. And me being Orthodox is, you know, it's happening with me or without me. There doesn't need to be an audience or microphones or a congregation or a coffee shop inside. It's just, if it's just the priest and there's a storm outside and no one shows up, the priest is still carrying on the liturgical calendar, right? It's part of our daily life. It's a calendar, and there's no bells and whistles. There's bells, don't get me wrong. There's church bells, but there's, you know, there's nothing flashy. There's no electronic, there's no technology. So I think as technology changes, in this country, it's changed so much, right? You have the Great Depression, and you have the Industrial Revolution, and then you have commerce, and then we have the internet, and we have smartphones, and you can't keep up with technology in the way that we are forming as humans. And so, but I think sometimes the evangelical church or the Christian church in America is trying to keep up with trends instead of just being a foundation, because they, you know, and I think that's the number one mistake. And you, you know, if you look at some films, and they can be, you know, I have my son's 21 and 24. I have two boys, and I try to like show them films that I grew up with, and it's insane how many films do not hold, they don't hold up at all because they were following a certain trend or style. And then you see films, let's say like, you know, Wim Wenders' film, Wings of Desire, that he, you know, filmed in Germany, and it holds up because it's not about a trend or a style, and it's very spiritual, even though it's not a spiritual film, because it's rooted in, you know, this one was rooted in Catholicism. And so I think that we're reminded when we see foreign films and it has something in it. I remember like growing up and seeing The Godfather, you know, a very Catholic-based film, and it's seeming like I wanted that, right? I wanted to feel that security or whatever that was of like going to a confessional booth and, you know, they're just going through these services. And being a traveling evangelist kid, it was like we were just keeping up with the times. And so I think films reflect that. I think America reflects that in a lot of things. Like when it comes to fashion, when you look at fashion, you know, I mean, look at just Google old pictures of Pablo Picasso when he's like, I don't know, 80 or 90. And he looks rad. He has like a striped shirt on with a handkerchief with a crazy cowboy hat. And it was just like simplicity. It was just sticking with originality. And not trying to, like I said, keep up with the times. And so I think it's full circle. And I think it happens all the time. And when you watch the Academy Awards, most of the films, no films are the blockbusters. You know, no films are the action car. Those are all the bank. The films that win the Academy Awards are the ones that people sat and felt. And, you know, like No Country for Old Men or There'll Be Blood, films like that, where you're just like, you're literally blown away because they didn't ask for you, they asked for your participation. They weren't trying to entertain you. They just asked you to listen. So mm-hmm. I think that's super important.
Did that, like, I mean, you sort of already answered this, but did that sort of critical eye towards trends and the critique of trend and profit-driven society and literally everything contribute to your decision to convert to Orthodoxy?
Oh, 100%. It was one of those things of, you know, I knew my boys or just the family in general needed a spiritual foundation. I knew it wasn't what I had been involved with. And, you know, it's like, I think my wife says it best where she's like, you know, I was done with the evangelical church, but I wasn't through with Christ. And so it's more of a, and it was like, let's go back to the beginning. And so we're like, what's the oldest? It's like, well, that's Catholic, right? And then a friend of ours was like, well, we go to the St. Seraphim Orthodox Church, which is the oldest church. You know, there was the Great Schism and the Catholic Church broke off and it became the Catholic Church, but the Orthodox Church is still doing the same thing that as whenever Christ was crucified, and it was the apostles were telling the tale, right? So it's the apostles, it's the saints, it's the St. John, St. Peter, St. Paul. They were telling the story, and it's the church hasn't changed. So yeah, there needs to be, I think for me, being a creative and absent-minded and human and always messing up, I think I just needed something that was consistent and wasn't going to change. And that way I could strive to be the best human I could be with those guidelines and then still be myself, but I couldn't chase, you know, trends.
Yeah, I think there's something so incredibly spiritual about like ancient things. I'm Jewish, and one of the things that I really like about it is the like ancientness of it. Mm-hmm. And the fact that like you're speaking this same language and saying these same prayers, which is very similar in Orthodoxy and Catholicism that you've been saying for thousands of years. Right, and you can really just feel that connection. It's really incredible.
Yeah, a lot of people, when they say, when I had my beard really big and my hair was growing out, I was in like Dumbo, New York, and which is, you know, predominantly Jewish workers. And one of the guys was walking and he goes, Shalom. I was like, oh, hey, I'm not Jewish, but like, I love it. And I remember being like, I want that. I want that. You know, I want whatever they have, like stopping everything. And I was shooting a commercial and he locked the door, rolled out the mat, had his pillow, and was doing his midday prayers. And then as I was leaving the studio, he goes, Josh, he's like, it's after a certain time. All my family's gone. Can you turn off the lights for me? And can you lock the door? Because, you know, no work after a certain time. And I was like, yes. And I remember like that just stuck with me. I was like, this is really rad, creative dude. And he's still following his religion. And there was something to be said about that, to be admired and to be, you know, and I just felt like, you know, Jesus is in my heart. You know, that's what, or whatever, you know, there was no structure, there was no calendar. And so, yeah, that's like full circle about Orthodoxy, maybe.
Yeah. And I totally agree. And I think there's something, I mean, obviously very performative and artistic and, you know, holy in a sense of like the theater coming together and the cinema and experience something together, and that coming from those, you know, from religious traditions. And I think that revisiting why that is really important for artists, even if, you know, you don't have to convert to Orthodoxy or Catholicism or Judaism or anything like that, but just revisiting that feeling and asking why am I feeling this way? Why do I want to say Shalom back? Why do I smile and you know, why is that? And that for me right there is like the it. You know?
Yeah. I mean, I grew up in the theatrical world, and still to this day, there's nothing that makes me happier than walking into the Okra House Theater, going backstage and having the routine, right? It's your routine. And if no one shows up, we've all been there. We've all been to a performance that we've done, and maybe it was a storm or something horrific happened and one person shows up, you know, and maybe they left at intermission, but the show goes on. And sometimes there's like a bit of a freedom to that, right? Where you're performing for whoever, right? If it's one person, two people, but you're performing for your castmates, you're performing and you do the routine. I mean, theater is such a, I mean, historically routine type of thing. We all have our, you know, little things that we do, superstitions or whatever people say, you know, habits. And there's, I think as human beings, we yearn for that. We want consistency, especially as creatives, we want something stable, you know. And when you're in theater, it is the church for us, right? I mean, it's like a holy place when you're on stage, and you know you wouldn't do things on a stage that you would maybe do after the show in an alley or something. So, you know, there's a lot of spirituality, you know, surrounding the arts. And yeah, and theater is always always goes back to theater for me, for sure.
Yeah, so let's dig into that. Can we hear the origin story of Josh David Jordan in your artistic, you know, when did you sort of really dig into stories? And you said it started very young. And obviously, as your father was a evangelical preacher traveling, I mean, I'm sure you have so many stories and so many different experiences and meeting different people, but where did it kind of click? And then when did you decide to make it a career, as it were?
Yeah.
Quote unquote. Always creatives, but.
Yes. Even though we don't get paid, it's still our career.
Right.
Yeah. Exactly. Like you said, my dad was a traveling evangelist. And so early on, you know, and to bring even back more, my dad was an actor, a really great actor. I've seen some of his stuff on film, and he was actually headed to NYU at some point, and then life changed. And so it's like in my DNA. I never knew it in the beginning, but we would go to different white tent revivals. This is back in the early 80s. And I would always go to the people who were the puppeteers or doing some type of Christian play. And I was just mesmerized by it. Like it was, that's it, right? And it was always like it's pre-internet, obviously. It's pre like cable TV. And so theater was everywhere. You know, there was always where we went, there was somewhere where someone was doing the Passion of the Christ play somewhere, you know. And so that got me going. I like performance. And I went to a Christian school. And then at some point I asked my parents, I was like, I really need to go to a real theatrical school. And a school had opened up in Dallas. I could walk there from my house. It was the first time any of us had gone to a public school. So it was kind of a big ordeal. But they had a brand new theater, and the theater's teacher's name was Mark Stinson, and he completely changed my life. I remember walking into the theater. I was super stressed just about life. You know, I'm a freshman, right? And I'm watching things like 90210, and I look nothing like Jason Priestley. I'm scrawny. I'm little. And, you know, I was playing sports, but I wasn't playing sports. I was on the sideline, and you're just trying to figure life out, you know? And he had us walk in the theater. We all laid down, and he played the theme song to Twin Peaks. And he had us close our eyes, and he said, "We're going to wash away this day. This day is gone." It's that, right? It's playing. And I remember getting back up, and he goes, "Okay, guys, go ahead and pick out your costumes that you think your character, you know, has." And we had a huge costume wardrobe area. I remember coming out and being like, I want to do this for the rest of, this is a thing I can do. And I'm with like-minded people. And they were like, "Hey, on Friday, we're all going to go see this thing at midnight called the Rocky Horror Picture Show." And I was like, "I don't know what that is. And I think midnight's past my bedtime. I don't think my parents are going to let me do that." So my parents were out of town. So I sort of snuck out of my house and I went and watched that. So I had a tribe, right, that understood that, you know, opening up your bathroom window per se and going out into the night and becoming a creature or a character. And they understood it. It meant something to me. And I did that forever. I went to University of Missouri. I had a theater scholarship, and I was even the school mascot. I was Truman the Tiger for the Mizzou Tigers. So, I mean, I took it that much farther. I came back to Dallas, Texas, and started doing films. I was acting in films, and I was in a pretty big film that happened. I got cast in that. And then I met Matthew Posey, who had just came back from Los Angeles. And I didn't know who he was. And a friend of ours was like, "You need to meet Matthew Posey. He has this theater called the Okra House Theater. It's phenomenal. The last play was amazing." And so he did not have auditions. He just met you. And so Matthew, after a long night of beers, goes, "Josh Jordan, would you be a part of the Okra House Theater?" That was my audition. And I never looked back, but that night that we were setting things up, I go, "Hey, why is there only one poster on the wall? What's the importance of that one poster?" And they were like, the guy who I was acting with goes, "Oh, we've only done one play here." And so I thought that I was a part of this like 30-year lineage theater, and they'd only done one play ever. And I've been a part of that for 15 years. And Matthew Posey is the lead of my film, El Tanto Per Cristo. He was in my second film. And, you know, Matthew told me, no matter what, if you're doing theater or if you're doing film, he's like, the one rule is never let the audience get ahead of you when you're writing your project, and never let the audience get ahead of you when you're performing. And so, theater runs through my veins, which was nice to do El Tanto Per Cristo like this, because we blocked it almost like theater doing these long one takes. So I was bringing a little Easter egg. I was bringing some theater back into cinema. Yeah.
That's amazing. We kind of have a similar story because I was the same. I was like, oh, I love playing dress up. And, you know, I would focus more on the stories of the Barbies than actually like caring about what they look like and stuff. and then, getting into college, I found a tribe of people, you know, kind of unwittingly. And they convinced me to audition for a devised Star Wars extended universe play. And I was like, okay, that sounds awesome. And it was in a black box and it was just totally so much fun. My parents thought I was crazy. Like, right. You know, my other, you know, degrees are in finance and Spanish. So
there you go.
They're like, what happened to you? Gotta have backup. Yeah, what happened to you there? And but you're right. You so find those people that are your tribe and they just get you. And sort of all of these stories that you have inside of you that are brewing and that you're curious about and like just endlessly curious about other people and you know, how they function, what they do and what they think, and just it's amazing. So yes, Mari, you had a question.
Oh, I don't remember what it was now, but I just think it's so funny that Rocky Horror seems like such a touch point for everybody. Amanda, do you have like a Rocky Horror story? Because okay, I know so we used to go in high school.
I forgot. That's where I had never even heard of the Rocky Horror Picture Show until I was 20 years old and in college, you know, and they're like, oh, you have to come. You have to come to this thing. And they're trying to explain the plot to me. And I'm like, wait, what? And, you know, and they're like, well, you dress up and then you have to have, you throw toast.
Yeah.
And they don't let you do that anymore. Oh. Like every theater is like no toast, no rice. It's horrible.
I can understand the no rice and maybe toast because when you make toast, like the smell lingers. But the Rocky, that was another one. Never in my life had heard of Rocky Horror Picture Show and so many other beautiful, amazing things. And not that my parents like sheltered me or anything like that. Mm-hmm. It's just like wasn't their thing.
How could you know? There wasn't the internet. I mean,
right,
maybe not when I was like 14, so there was no internet then, but
yeah. And it's also like if you're not in like a major metro area, you're not gonna find out about it. I mean, we had one theater around us that did it. They did it like a couple times a year. They did it on Halloween and then like two or three other times a year, but you know, otherwise none of us would have heard of it. But it is like it's like your introduction to ancient rituals that connects you to generations before. It's so funny how it
Tim Curry. And it was, it's so ridiculous. You know, I grew up in a town of 1,200 people, you know, 2.5 hours west of, you know, almost South Dakota. And so like, you know, the closest movie theater was 30 minutes away and the closest grocery store and all that. So yeah, it really wasn't something that that I had ever come in contact or anybody else for that matter knew about or watched or anything. So it was like a whole new world going to college and meeting these people. It was just like walking into a library that you didn't know existed. It was just totally. Like, it was amazing, from philosophy to art to music to it was a wild time and so fun. So but getting back to El Tonto Por Cristo, so can you tell us a little bit about the process of when you started writing and mm-hmm. how that came together? And for some other folks out there, not just writers and actors and directors, but also, you know, on the producing side, how did the money for this kind of come together? Yeah. And do you have any advice for folks who are trying to get their work out there?
For sure. You know, just going back to my first film, This World Won't Break, which is a 2-hour film. It went to, I think, 15 festivals and went across the world. And I made that movie for $36,000. And it was a lot of ask, a lot of in-kinds, a lot of hustle. And with this film, with El Tonto Por Cristo, you know, I really, like we said, it wasn't at the top of my list, but it was something that I knew that needed to be made. And I write a little bit different, maybe, than most people. I have these Moleskine books, journals that I constantly write. I'd fill them out. And sometimes they never see the light of day and sometimes they do. And then once I have enough that I have something, I start making note cards of all the scenes. I have like about 70, 72. Like these are things that should happen. And then I use a tape recorder. Well, now we have our phone. I use voice memos and I do the dialogue. That's how I write because I can't type as fast as my thoughts are. And if anyone were to ever get a hold of my phone, they would put me in a mental institution because I actually do all the voices and I do the inflections and it's almost like timed out perfectly by the time. So when I sit down to write, I'm really just gathering all the information and I put it together and that's the first draft of the script. And it, during that time, what I do, and I've had the luxury because I've filmed where I live, is I drive to the locations. I drive when it's sunset, sundown, I take photos. So by the time we're even, you know, getting ready to shoot, I know the ins and outs of what the place looks like at noon. You know, I can tell the DP where the sun, this is going to be in the shadow. So maybe we need to push this till six. So for me, it's like I do, you know, if you're a filmmaker and you're not making films with studios or large investors, I always say like, you know, you don't have money, but you do have time. I know that we think that we don't have time, but we do. It's like, I didn't watch anything. I wasn't watching Netflix. I wasn't going to the movies. I wasn't meeting my friends to watch the game at the bar. I wasn't doing any of those things. I was literally prepping and doing pre-production for the film. So by the time we were ready, you don't really have a lot of time to make a movie. This past movie, El Tanto per Cristo, was shot in 14 days.
Oh, and wow. That yeah, it was shot in really fast.
It's That's really impressive. Fast. And we were able to do it because I was ready to go. I mean, I had this, I don't do storyboards, but I have photographic storyboards in a way for the DP and for my production team to look at. And then I do mainly all the costume design. So I spend months picking out things like this film's in black and white. I was picking out like the perfect shade of something. And it wasn't for me or for the camera. It was for the actor. It was for the environment. It was so everything felt really lived in and felt real. And we shoot like that. We shoot there's not a lot of people on set. There's not a lot of lights. I think that's probably coming from the theatrical world of just having tangible things, you know. It's like putting certain things in your pocket as an actor or, you know, wearing a certain shoe gets you in character. I think that as a director and as a filmmaker, you can really provide that for your actors by doing as much of the work as you can. And so this film, it was a SAG movie. It was a SAG ultra low film and we were getting ready to film and a little thing called the SAG strike happened in 2023 in September. So it was 2 years ago. We started filming. And they were like, there's no films, yada, yada, yada. But I had already rented vans, hotels, airplane tickets. And I was like, well, I can't push the movie because if I push the movie, I'm going to lose 75% of my budget or 75% of the money that we have. And so every day, me, my wife, my other producer, and another co-producer, we emailed and called the SAG office. I don't recommend people do this because it's not a very nice thing, but we did. And we reminded them that we needed to shoot and that we needed a SAG interim agreement. And they would say, well, you can't shoot because you need the SAG interim agreement. And I would say, right. But on September 7th, we start shooting. She's like, but you can't. I was like, why? She goes, you don't have the SAG interim agreement. I said, that's why we need that, because we're starting on the 7th. I was explaining to them. And so we got ours. They sent it at like 2 a.m. And we were the last film to get the SAG interim agreement during the SAG strike. And we never looked back. And they never came and visited. I think because they were so underwater with everything happening. And so we were just left alone for 2 weeks and, you know, far coastal Texas. And we were able to make the movie. And it really was, there's something that I think a lot of people need to understand is there's never a good time to make a film. Like there's never the perfect time to make, you know, to do a theatrical production because someone's mother's in the hospital or someone's sick or you lost an actor or, you know, something happened with the plumbing and you're down to one bathroom or whatever. There's always going to be an inconvenience and there's always going to be something that says no. And I think that's why really good art comes out of that because I don't think people would really push and be miserable and feel so stressed out if they didn't believe in something, right? And I think sometimes when there's money involved, you can throw money at problems and you're not really thinking about, is this still good or not? But when you know something's good and you feel it in your heart and you have an ensemble who shows up for you and they're willing to give away their weekends and nights for some peanut butter and jelly sandwiches and, you know, sharing an Airbnb, they know that it's something that they want to put their name on. And, you know, sometimes it's best to not have much money, because sometimes if you have a little bit of money, everyone's going to want a little bit of that little bit of money. And so sometimes it's better not to have money. That way you're like, I got no money. You guys still want to do this? We can do it. I mean, we took care of our SAG actors. You know, we have, you got to pay the insurance stuff and all the nerdy things. So because of all that, I had prepped for months and months in advance, and I had all the cassocks, I had the locations, I had all the fishing gear, I had all the stuff, and we were off to the races. So, you know, it would have been a very, very, very expensive film if, you know, we hadn't done all the pre-work and then had actors who, you know, like Matthew Posey's been in No Country for Old Men, Magnificent Seven. He's been in a ton of stuff, and he has a new play coming out this week. He's constantly working his craft. And so you have people who are ready. And that's, I think that's why I think it's so important to get theatrical actors. You know, it's a different kind of acting, obviously. You know, you're not projecting as much. It's more internal, but that's my favorite people to work with.
Yeah. And I think that everything that you've said is just so emblematic of the fact that, you know, I think if you're like outside of the entertainment industry or the theater and the film world, you don't know how much both the SAG and the writer strikes really shook things up. Mm. The industry is like completely restructuring. And I think it is moving more towards things like El Tonto Por Cristo, more small budget, even micro budget, independent projects. And I'm curious, do you agree that you think that that's kind of the way of the future? Because I just don't see any other way that things are going to get made.
No, it's crazy. And it's, I don't think you can see that, but my umbrella production company is called Wild West Filmmaking, because it's just the wild, wild west out there. I mean, obviously I'm in Texas, but I mean, I think that Hollywood doesn't know what's happening. I have friends that live out in LA and they're like, Josh, it's kind of over. Like the ways that have been for 100 years and the way things work, it's not happening. A lot of them are unemployed because you have to sign on to these bigger studios like a Netflix and, you know, and move and work for a lower rate. And so I think people, and that's what I, and you guys know this, is whenever there's something traumatic or things are broken, you know, like the most beautiful things in the world are those that are shattered, molded, and then put back together again by artists. And I think we're in that time where we're really going to see a lot of good art. I'm already really seeing it. I'm already seeing some really phenomenal films. And I'm just like blown away. And, you know, I'm seeing a lot of I love foreign films, but I'm seeing like the most solid foreign films. You're just like, you know, I'm weeping when I'm watching these films. And I think it's because of what happened, you know, and people trying to hold on to those rules and regulations, and people are saying, well, I'm just going to make it on my own. And when you do, there's a realness that comes out of that.
Absolutely. Yeah. And it's like you brought up like the Easy Riders and the new Hollywood in the 70s. And I think that so much of what we're seeing right now is really kind of a recycling of that, when the studio system just broke down and they were just like, you know what? Like we can't make these big budget things anymore. We'll take a chance on you, kid. Make your project. I think you're already starting to see that happen. And I mean, you see a lot of these big summer blockbusters fail and people don't like them. And then something like, obviously, like this is a bigger budget thing, but something like Anora.
For sure.
People adored. And I really hope that we can continue to do this. And I mean, we're coming up on time, but I'm curious about your experience, and then we can have like two more questions and then we gotta stop for the radio time. But your experience with crowdfunding.
Yeah.
Because I think a lot of people either don't want to do it, are scared to do it, or just have had a bad experience where they didn't end up getting the funding that they needed. What was your experience crowdfunding this movie?
Yeah. So crowdfunding was something that we weren't prepared to do at first. It's very vulnerable, but it's also really time consuming. It's like a full-time job. And my wife, Jessica Jordan, she's the producer of the film. I mean, she took that on. And, you know, one bit of advice off the top is you really can't do a crowdfunding as you're making a movie. And so it needs to be before to raise the money for, it could be pre-production if you need to raise the money for pre-production or production, just getting it in the can. And for us, it was, we did it for the post score wrap up and to launch the theatrical tour. And so that's what we did. And really with, because you're doing something where people are giving you money and you're giving them something in return, and you want it as an artist to be something true and something real. And so that takes a lot of your time, and it's really tough. I mean, I think crowdfunding is amazing. I think it's good to have an Avenue B, just to have like a GoFundMe for people who do want to just throw you $20, $50, $1,000, because, you know, you were on their heart or something and they don't want anything in return. It's good to have that going. We won a couple of grants, and that's a full-time job, filling out grants. You know, and all this is while I have my, you know, freelance job of making things in video and making a movie. Kickstarter and all these things were full-time jobs too. But, you know, we do live in the day and age of you can control those things on your phone and you can work remotely, and it's not easy. And I think, you know, a lot of people ask, or they have their goals set too high for a Kickstarter. I think it's really good to do something pretty low and just see what costs you need. I don't really think that we're in the day and age where you can fund a film on Kickstarter anymore. I think we're way past that day and age, because it's a little bit saturated. And even with GoFundMes, it's hard because there's always we live in this fully connected world where there's a flood somewhere or there was a fire somewhere and people have given. And so I say try to get as much in-kinds as you can when you're making your production, which is, you know, if people don't know what in-kinds are, they're things that have large value that you're getting for some type of barter or trade. You know, for me, it's like I worked in Dallas and I worked for this production house, a rental house, and I would just help them out sometimes on the weekends. I would stay late. I would do extra work. And then on this film, they gave me a lot of gear for 2 weeks, just in kind, you know, and that could have been around, I think it was about $100,000 in gear for a 2 week shoot. And so if you start adding things up like that, and then it always goes back to, you know, that's a relational thing. So I always tell people, if you want to be in this industry, if you want to be in the creative world, you know, don't burn any bridges, be respectable as much as you can, be a stand-up person, and help others as much as you can on all of their projects, because I couldn't have made El Tanto Per Cristo if these actors weren't on my things, but I was also on their things. So I think I answered more than the crowdfunding, but yeah, I think it all goes hand in hand. I think it's different for everybody, but just be prepared if you're going to be crowdfunding. Like ours has already ended and most people have gotten their prizes and stuff, but it's still like, you know, someone will be like, hey, on the Kickstarter wall, my name's spelled wrong. It's, you know, Billy with an IE. And you're like, okay, I'll fix that. So it's a full-time job. Just know, yeah, it's never ending. Making movies is never ending.
Yeah. And I want to expand just on what you said. It like, you know, it's, you mentioned your wife and some of the actors and people that you'd work with on other productions. It's so important for people to surround themselves with others that are very inspired and passionate and hardworking and believe in each other and really have a deep respect for each other's work. Because if you don't have that, you're kind of you're trying to do it all, like you said, and you can't do it all yourself. You have to, I mean, there's so many facets to this and it's ongoing. It's 24/7, it's all on your phone. And you know, you really need that support of people that you've met, of like-minded artists, you know?
Mm-hmm. No, for sure. I mean, I think at the end of the day, unfortunately, no one cares as much as you do about your film. And you better care so much, because really, we're human beings. And there was moments on this El Tanto Per Cristo where I could see the weariness in people's eyes that, you know, a month ago over beers were like, dude, I'll stay up all night. Let's pull some all-nighters and keep filming. And you hit that 10-hour mark and people are like, they get hangry and they get tired and life happens. And so it's hard. There's, you know, my wife was, we were like two ships in the night, even though we were on the same production. Cause I was sleeping 2 hours and so was she, but she was on the production side and she was making things happen. And I was making things happen. And yeah, you have to be okay with those things too. And, you know, you're trying to be nice, but you're also trying, this is your film, right? It's your project you've worked years on, and you don't want to be cruel, but you also want to be stern. But you always have to be kind. Yeah.
Yeah. So we're coming to the close here, but yeah. I just want to make sure, because I pulled up your tour dates. So October 6th, Texas Theater, Dallas, Texas. Be there. Well, and also, it says an Art Deco landmark in the heart of Oak Cliff. Ooh, I love Art Deco. That's
also
like totally my...
I want to plug the Minnesota screening, which is also on the El Tanto Por Cristo website. It is on November 13th. The time is not listed. I'm sure it is if you click the ticket 6
button.
Is 6 p.m.
doors on that.
Amazing. Yes, it's November 13th at the Columbia Heights Theater. If you've never been, it's gorgeous. If you go for the movie, stay for the beautiful building. And there's going to be a Q&A. Are you going to be there?
Oh, I'm going to be at every single one of these. And we also are wrapping up our double vinyl LP soundtrack. So we'll have vinyl records of the movie's soundtrack. It'll actually have dialogue from the movie, kind of like how Disney used to do it back in the day. And we'll have some cool tour shirts. There's a coffee mug that says I Arise Today. It's one of the lines from the movie, and we'll have all kinds of crazy things. We'll have some giveaways. It's going to be like we're trying to do what they did in the early 2000s with indie rock, is like, we're bringing this thing on tour. It's going to be an experience, and you don't want to miss it.
It's like punk rock orthodoxy. Ooh, I love it.
Yeah.
Seriously. I love it. And okay, like, so November 13th, Heights Theater in Columbia Heights, Minnesota. Doors are at 6 p.m. Josh David Jordan will be there. And yeah, come check it out. It's going to be beautiful. And just, you mentioned the score. We saw the, you sent us the trailer for it. Mm-hmm. And the music is incredible. Whoever did that, shout out to them.
Michael Paris-Gavis. He's an Emmy winning. He did Agatha All Along for Disney and Ant-Man and the Wasp and Avengers. And he's orthodox, and I've known him forever. And he went on this crazy journey with me.
It is absolutely stunning. So I definitely for sure will try to be there and get a record. I'm expecting, so
okay,
if my little girl doesn't make an early appearance, I will be there. We will be there together with my husband, and it'll be great. So it'll be a beautiful, beautiful time.
I don't think I cussed, did I? I think we did good. Did I do okay?
It was perfect. Kept it so clean. And
I'm
so sad because
time.
We could, I feel like we could do another hour of this, but unfortunately the radio does not agree with us. Josh David Jordan, where can people find you?
Yeah, you can find me at Josh David Jordan with a little underscore on Instagram, or wildwestfilmmaking.com or eltantoporcristo.com. That's where I'm at. I got thrown off Facebook a couple years ago, and just because of it was my thing got hacked, and I never rebuilt. Maybe one day I'll rebuild, but I think I have a page on Facebook that you can go to, and it'll kick back to my email. But yeah, Instagram is the best way. Hit me a message, follow the journey. We're gonna have all behind the scenes. We'll be in Romania and Greece and at the end of October, so follow that crazy journey. It's gonna be wild.
Love it.
Yeah, thank you so much, and thank you all for listening.
Thanks, Frogtown. Bye.